It was only a dozen years ago, but it seems as if all the stories about the internet before Google should begin once upon a time. Then two Stanford University graduate students had an idea, and that grew into a multi-billion dollar company that's available at the touch of a button. Google is ubiquitous, and for almost anyone with a computer, it's become indispensable, and it's even become a verb. But until now, much of its inner workings have remained mysterious. Stephen Levy's new book, In the Plex, explores the history of this remarkable company, illuminates some of the questions surrounding its practices, and peers into its future. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Levy back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
So how long after Google began did you start working on this book?
Well, Google started, and the search engine really launched in 1998, and they launched as a company formally with a venture capital in 1999. And at the end of that year was when I first visited Google. I was working for Newsweek at the time, and it became one of the companies I covered most when I was at Newsweek. About 3 years ago, I moved to Wired. So in a sense, I've been working on this thing since 1999, but I really got serious in 2008, because the year before I had gone on a trip with a bunch of young Google managers. They invited me to go along. And they have this program where they train these managers. They sort of pluck them out very early in their career or straight out of school. They give them huge responsibility. They say, you're in charge of Gmail. You're in charge of launching this product for ads. And halfway through this program, one of the Google executives, Marissa Meyer, takes them to visit international offices. So I went around the world with these people and spent 16 days with them. And being around these people 24/7, I realized there was a dimension of the company which I hadn't got. And there were, maybe if I could do a whole book like this, I can get underneath the surface.
But, well, there are a couple of things here. When I first realized that it's only a dozen years, it kind of stunned me, 1999 to today. It's kind of shocking. But I was surprised that you were allowed into their privacy conferences, because it's my sense that Google is very secretive. They seem to be very willing to share information about me but not share any information about themselves.
Right. And I sort of compare it to a lobster. Internally, they share everything with each other, but it's sort of tough to get in from outside. So it's got this hard shell. And I think in part because I had been writing about it a long time and we had built up a trust. And in part they thought it maybe was working to their disadvantage that they were so opaque, because they ask a lot of us and regulators are looking at it very closely now. So I guess they figured if they let someone in, even though I might expose the wart here and there, overall people might understand it better and be less terrified of it.
Did you have to learn the lingo?
Yes, I did. And that helped me a lot. You know, they have a very intricate lingo, you know, with all these acronyms. There's OKRs and GPSs and GPAs, and they refer to the cafes a certain way. And once I did, I found that people opened up to me much more. Pretty soon, the interviews I was having were less like a reporter talking to a subject than someone unburdening to a colleague.
Because you could speak in their jargon and let them know that you understood what they were going through. But, you know, it sounds to me like a lot of what they're going through is kind of free lunch. In fact, they do have free lunch, don't they?
Yeah, there is a such thing as free lunch at Google, and dinner too.
Then they do your dry cleaning and they give you massages?
Dry cleaning. I was at the campus about a week ago and they have this big truck where people are going in for haircuts and styling.
So is there do you get to a point where you're tempted to be co-opted by the Google culture?
Well, I ate some meals here. I didn't get a haircut. But when you sit down and write, then you're distance. You know, I wasn't on the campus there, and I was able just to go into the zone where I was talking to my readers.
A lot of people must apply. Who is Google most likely to hire?
It's very much like the process of selecting for an elite school like Harvard or Stanford. And that's no coincidence, because the founders went to Stanford. They come from academic families. No matter how old you are, if you apply to Google, they're going to want to know your SAT scores and your college GPA. And they're going to look over it. They'll say, why did you get a C in that class? What happened there? And you're saying, I don't know. It was 20 years ago. And people have actually told me that.
And is it true that its founder, Larry Page, actually vets every one of the applicants?
That's right. I was surprised to hear that. And I thought maybe that information must be several years old. But I asked him, an interview just about a year ago now, do you still do that? And he said, yes. He takes a look at the package, and he's the final sign-off on every single employee. It's been over 30,000 so far that he's vetted.
And how many employees right now?
It's 24,000 now, and they say they're going to hire 6,000 more in the next year.
You say to understand them, you have to know that Larry Page and Sergey Brin went to Montessori schools. But so have millions of other people, although not all of them have parents who taught computer science in colleges.
And not many other people have founded companies that operates on principles of Montessori.
That's what it really is? They have.
Well, it's not explicit, but, and the person who pointed this out to me was Marissa Mayer, a very early employee who knows the founders very well. And it does – and I actually went and I read some books by Maria Montessori to see how deeply that was integrated into the company. It turns it is. It's not just a questioning authority. It's an idea that discipline can come, a different kind of discipline, from pursuing what you really want to do. And that's really built into what happens at Google. If you're a manager at Google, you can't tell an engineer what to do. You have to interest an engineer into doing what you think is the right thing to do.
Was something like that happening at Stanford University's graduate computer science program?
Well, I think that in terms of academia, a student will get to pursue what he or she wants to do. And so I think really the culture there is a blend of that Montessori freedom or anti-authoritarianism and a campus. And I think it's very consciously set up that they want to be like a campus.
My guest is Stephen Levy, whose latest book is In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You casually drop the word Asperger's when you talk about Larry Page. I've heard that about any number of computer geeks. Aren't they all a little Asperger's, at least to us outsiders?
Right. I should say that was not a diagnosis, but sort of a description. I said that some people wonder whether there's a jigger of Asperger's in his personality. And I think, like you say, like a lot of people.
Bill Gates, I've heard the same thing.
Yeah. I think having spent a lot of time with Bill Gates, I think this is more pronounced there. Larry doesn't rock back and forth and kind of go into a zone like that. But he is someone, if you ask him a question, he'll just take it very seriously. And other times he just won't talk. And I think it just shows the concentration in his personality and the super intense focus, which is uncommon.
Which you describe as what you say is ambition. Do you mean personal ambition?
No. The ambition that Larry holds in very, very high esteem is just the desire to do big, big things. Now, he believes that we live in a time where it's easier than ever to make a very ambitious attempt to do something into reality. Technology puts these things into our reach that we couldn't do before. And a lot of us don't do these big things because we're locked into the old ways of thinking when it wasn't possible to do these kinds of things. So I think one reason why Google's been successful in doing some of the things they call moonshots is that they're unencumbered by this. And I think probably each generation is more liberated to do big things. For instance, Facebook now has done some things that Google hasn't done because its founder is 10 years younger than the Google founders.
Although the people at Apple are older, and when I read comparisons of the Android system and the iPhone system, people still prefer the iPhone.
Well, I think Steve Jobs has this incredible talent that he's able to challenge that. He's one person who is not encumbered by those things, and that's one reason why he's so extraordinary.
Now, what about Sergey Brin? Is he also ambitious in the same way? And would you use the word Asperger's in describing him?
Right. Again, I'm not diagnosing Larry.
I understand. You're not a doctor.
Yeah. But I'd say Sergey is more social than Larry. He's more mercurial. He's very mischievous.
He used to rollerblade through Stanford.
Yeah, and he rollerblades through Google now, and so when you talk to him a lot, he's into acrobatics, so he'll stretch. So presumably later on, he could ride the trapeze or something. And he's a lot of fun. And he's actually now in Google's new organization, constructed a role for himself, which is totally freewheeling. You know, he's not connected to anything. His title now is co-founder. Originally had a title president. So while everyone else has these very specific responsibilities, Sergey goes where he wants to go, and he's spending a lot of time now in a semi-secret area of Google that does big, long-range projects.
Well, some of his teachers described his proposals as more science fiction than computer science.
Right. That was mainly Larry, I think. Yeah. Both of them share that. Both of them have a big interest in things like space elevators and other kinds of futuristic stuff. We'll take pretty seriously.
Well, aside from their Montessori backgrounds, what else do you think they have in common?
I think they have in common. Well, both of them are very serious computer scientists and very talented ones. So I think they're both very deeply grounded in the mathematics and artificial intelligence techniques of computer science, and particularly the artificial intelligence. From my earliest days of talking to them, they would invoke AI time and time again and talk about things like implants that one day we'd have where we would be able to Google without even thinking of it. And right now, indeed, Google is pursuing a course of things that's known internally as zero-query search, where the search gets done before you even say what you're searching for.
Well, sometimes that gets a little annoying. I start typing in three letters and they're immediately telling me what I'm looking for when it can be something totally different.
It could, but the reason why they have the confidence to do that is that Google does relentless testing. So, maybe you're in the minority, and maybe in the future it'll be able to gear itself just to you, what you like and what you don't like. But they find that when they try something new, they'll measure it very precisely to see if people search more after they implement the feature.
Well, they didn't invent web search. Yahoo was around before them and doing very well. So what did they do to replace Yahoo?
Well, in a sense, that was the idea of thinking freshly. People thought search was solved. People thought, well, people find what they want pretty well. And the model then was to build these portals on the internet, places you'd go that were, your little home base, and that would send you off to other kinds of things. It would be a combination newspaper and TV station and, personal day book and, the events you like to go to. And they would put ads there, and they didn't want search to be too good. They thought if search was too good, people would leave and they wouldn't get you back. And literally, Larry and Sergey showed Google to people hoping to sell the technology, and they were thrown out of one place saying, this is too good. I don't want this on my portal.
It was too good?
Yes. The people from, Excite. They had a guy they hired, who was an East Coast media guy to be their adult supervision. And he was appalled when he saw how good Google worked.
Well, the big problem for all of the search engines was, how do you make any money from this?
Yeah.
Is that where they were most innovative initially?
They were just as innovative in their business model, as it turned out, as they were in the search engine. And this was something that they didn't know how they would do this when they started the company. But when they weren't getting very much in the way of revenues, they built this product called AdWords, which is really probably the most successful product ever on the internet and one of the most successful products in business of all time.
Although not all of us appreciate it.
Oh, actually, again, they're testing it. And as it turns out, the search ads, and these are these little ads that appear on the right side of your search results when you Google things. And they're not very intrusive. And quite often, they're quite useful. And that's because it's cheaper for an advertiser to put a useful ad than it is for an ad that doesn't help you. And Google tests this relentlessly. And as it turns out, when they show people search results without ads, they don't search as more. So that keeps telling them that people like the ads.
But I think it's not so much the ads in the search engine that bother people as the people who have signed on to Gmail and feel that that Google is reading their mail, and that's why they're getting certain kinds of ads.
Well, that was a big problem. And actually, that was what jarred Google into all its privacy controversies, that product. Even though there's deeper problems of privacy on the internet that Google's right in the middle of, that was what made people say, what's going on here? Actually, it's not people reading your mail. It's just, their system is looking at the content, deciding what ad might be appropriate to show you there. And as it turns out, in every system, they sort of look at your mail anyway, not necessarily to show ads, but to make sure there's no spam or viruses in there.
But in a sense, I don't care whether it's an algorithm or a person who's reading my mail or is searching through my mail. I don't want it done. That's my personal stuff. I realize that if I use the email at my company has the right, because of the, there have been legal precedents, has the right to know what's going on there. But if I'm doing something at home to my friends, why should anybody have access to that?
Well, right. Well, that's a big issue with what's now being called cloud computing, where your information doesn't live on your computer itself, but is somewhere off on the internet and often in a place you don't even know where it is. And in that case, it is a big issue, because then we have to trust the place, the companies which hold that information. And, you know, Google depends on us trusting it.
My guest is Stephen Levy, who's covered Google for over a decade, first at Newsweek, where he was senior editor and chief technology writer, now at Wired, where he's a senior writer. He's also written about Apple, and he has written about hackers, and that has brought him to our show in the past. His latest is called In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Stephen Levy, whose latest book is In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, published by Simon & Schuster. How important is Larry Page's PageRank in the development and success of Google?
Well, originally, this was the breakthrough that allowed Google to search much more effectively than any of the search engines that came before it. And what it does is it sort of analyzes all the links on the web and figures out what people like the most for a given subject and gives you that. It's sort of a way to almost exploit the crowd intelligence of people using the web. But as time went on, that became less prominent a factor. It's still important in the search engine, but they've used a lot of other techniques. A lot of them deal with teaching the search engine, really, about the world at large. The search engine is a learning machine, and it learns things by the way people interact with it. For instance, if people search for dogs and they don't get a result they like, they might then type in puppies. And that teaches the search engine, maybe dogs and puppies are similar things. I've learned a synonym.
But as the web grew, why didn't it complicate the working of PageRank and slow it down?
Because, you know, this is another strength of it, that as the web got bigger and bigger and bigger, it didn't get in Google's way. It actually helped Google get better results, because the more things that came in, the more links there were, and the more Google had to work with in delivering results that people wanted.
Some other contributors were Amit Singhai and a Chinese engineer named Yanhong Li, who came up with RankDex.
Right, right. They had a whole lot of different new people come in. And this was another secret of why Google was successful. Everyone, you know, was charmed with the initial search engine. But in its early years, Sergey and Larry managed to convince a number of really expert computer scientists to come to work for the company, when really it had very little going for it in terms of a guaranteed future. It had a cool search engine, but it wasn't making any money. But they convinced these people to come in there, and this group of engineers that came between 1999 and 2001, a lot of them are still there, were able to build out on the search engine and make it handle, you know, the queries of billions of people.
Well, Larry Page is a big fan of Nikola Tesla,
right?
A man everyone agrees was a genius, but who had a rather sad life. Did he learn anything from?
Well, he did. He didn't want to be Tesla himself. He didn't want to be the kind of person that came up with a great advance and then wound up in poverty as someone else took his advance from him. So maybe that's one reason that he's a little wary about sharing information about what Google's doing with the public. But he's very careful and has extracted a lot of lessons from that.
Well, Arthur C. Clarke said that the truly successful technology is more like magic. And Google does have that kind of aura to it. You type in a couple of letters, and the next thing you know, you have a million entries.
That's right. That Arthur Clarke quote is, you know, used by every company in Silicon Valley, saying, "Well, we're the magical people." But Google really was one of the few companies that lived up to that, because when you first typed in some obscure query into the search engine and got just the result you needed from all the billions of possible results on the web, it really did seem like magic.
But as the company grew, wasn't it more and more difficult to guarantee secrecy? People leave the company.
Yeah. Well, it is tough, though. I guess people just generally don't leave and take the code with them. There is honor among engineers. And though in China, maybe that's a different matter that Google is actually concerned with.
And we'll talk about China in a little while because Google's having more problems with China again just recently in the news. Where did the name Google come from?
Google is a term for one followed by 100 zeros, a big number. And that symbolized the huge amount of data that the founders wanted to process.
There were other names that they considered.
Well, Backrub was the name of
Backrub?
That was the name of the original search engine. That's because they used the backlinks of the web. And then they were thinking of Whatbox, but that sounded sort of porny to them. They didn't want to put that in.
Now, at a certain point, they had to make presentations to investment bankers. How much were they willing to reveal?
Not as much as other companies that made their presentations to the venture capitalists. And they had a young Stanford graduate, their ninth employee, who was hired to help them out and present the slides. And he was amazed they would go in there and not answer some questions from the venture capitalists. And traditionally, you always did that. He said, "You're going to offend them." But they said, "Don't worry, we know what we're doing."
Well, were they worried at all that they really didn't have the kind of experience that a company that is as ambitious as theirs was would have? I mean, neither of them was really prepared to be a CEO.
In their minds, they were, and they very much wanted it. But as it turned out, they really needed the money because they had to buy a lot of these servers, these computers to store the information, and it was pretty slow to Google something in its early days. Sometimes it'd take a couple seconds to get the results back, and they wanted it much, much faster. So they needed the money, and they accepted this compromise from the venture capitalists that, yes, if we got our money, our $25 million from the two biggest venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, we would hire a CEO to give us, quote, adult supervision.
So they hired Scott Epstein, who didn't last all that long.
Right. He was a guy they hired considering for marketing. The guy they eventually hired was Eric Schmidt. But before that, they called up John Doerr, who was one of the venture capitalists, and said, "We've changed our mind. We're going to do it ourselves." And he said, and his first instinct was to say, "I'm out of here." But he held back. He said, "Why don't we do this? Why don't we take a tour? I'll give you the names of the best CEOs. And you talk to them and find out if you really do need someone more experienced to come in." And they did a big tour, and they came back and said, "Well, we found the guy we want to be CEO." And John Doerr said, "Terrific. Who is it?" He said, "Steve Jobs." And that wasn't going to happen. But he did convince them to take this fellow, Eric Schmidt, who was who they liked because he was also a computer scientist, and he actually made a product that they used at Stanford.
And was that a successful collaboration?
It was rocky at first. Each party had to get used to the others, but eventually it did work out. And there was like 200 people when Eric Schmidt came, and there was well over 20,000 people and $30 billion in revenue when he left. So one would have to consider it a success.
Then they had the successful IPO, and did that sudden enrichment to the workforce present a serious threat to the culture? Because the culture was
it did and
very non-corporate.
Well, growth itself presented a challenge to them because they always want to think like a small company. And then money also changes things. Now, the day after the IPO, the head of engineering at the time gave a talk to all the people at Google. And he stood up on a box with a baseball bat. And he said, "If I see any Porsches in the parking lot that weren't there yesterday, I'm going to smash in the windshield."
Why do you say that the original total value of the shares being offered was a mathematical joke?
Well, this is, Larry and Sergey are always doing things like this. They're really playful. So they did this thing called Euler's constant, and that was the number of shares there. They're always big also on April Fool's jokes and things like that.
In fact, they did this on April 1st, didn't they?
Well, they introduced Google on April 1st. They didn't do their IPO on April 1st. Of course, their IPO got postponed because they had done an interview for Playboy magazine, which got them into trouble.
Well, introducing your company on April 1st would suggest that the whole thing is a big joke.
Right. The Gmail,
were they hurt by that?
Well, the answer to the Gmail was of their April 1st stunts. You know, introducing that serious product on April 1st turned out to be a big problem because a lot of people thought it was a joke. Because at the time, they were giving away more storage for email than any company had given away before, you know, like over 10 times as much as their competitors. So that took a while. Then the joke was on them when people started complaining about privacy.
And then there's that unofficial motto of Google, which I assume would have been a warning to some people in Wall Street.
Yeah. Their motto was, don't be evil. And when they went public...
They didn't hear about Gecko?
You know, probably not, because, you know, like Larry and Sergey aren't big popular culture fans. But they actually said in their, you know, S-1, the announcement of they were going public, that sometimes, you know, we're going to take this don't be evil thing so seriously, we're going to sacrifice profits for the good of humanity. You know, if we think that we could do something that make us money that might not be good for the world, we won't do it. And shareholders should understand that.
Was there a rift in the culture between those employees who had arrived early on and had valuable stock options and those who joined later?
As much as Google tried to prevent it, of course there was. You know, there were, as things went on, especially after, you know, the stock just went up and up and up for the next couple of years, and then the people who got their jobs when the stock was really high, obviously weren't as well off as those who came in there when options were really cheap. And even the masseuse at Google became a millionaire.
When I mentioned earlier that people were concerned about privacy with Gmail, which they introduced to great success somewhere down the line, was it the image they had of themselves as good guys that led them to be blindsided by complaints about privacy issues?
I think that was part of it. I think that they knew in their hearts that they were good. So why would people, you know, complain about this? And for the Gmail thing, clearly, you know, a lot of people shared your feeling that this is kind of creepy, that, you know, it looks like they're reading my mail. And to them, they said, no, we have the explanation. We have the data why this isn't bad. So you should understand this.
Why did they break with Apple, where they'd had a very nice working relationship for quite a while?
Yeah, they had a what looked like, you know, Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart kind of relationship with Apple. Those two companies they had entirely complementary product suites, and they would, you know, go together to rule Silicon Valley and the world. But what happened was that Larry Page in particular thought it was really important that Google establish itself in the mobile world, in the phone world. And the fact that Apple was gearing itself for that same space didn't bother him. And Steve Jobs knew that they were doing a phone, but wasn't aware of how close the phone they were doing was to his iPhone. And when he found out, he flipped out.
He felt personally betrayed?
Yes, he did.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, most people still rate the iPhone higher, and they rate the iPad higher than all of the new iPads that have come along. Has Apple got a lead that will be hard to catch up to? Or do you think Google, being the brilliant company it is, might eventually catch up?
Well, they have a lead in how much they can get for their phones, and they make the most money from the phones. But the Android phones, the Google phones, are actually outselling the iPhones now.
What happened to Google in China? Was part of the problem just cultural?
There were a lot of problems. You know, this is Google's China experience, and I spent a lot of time on this in the book, really began with a compromise that was really unacceptable to a lot of people at Google. They really had to grit their teeth and go into it. And that was that the only way that they can get a license to practice business in China with their search engine was to censor the results that people got according to the political and other demands of the Chinese government. And this was particularly abhorrent to Sergey Brin, whose family had come over from Russia to escape oppression.
Well, Bob Dylan is willing to make the compromise.
Well, you know, Bob doesn't think as hard about these things as Sergey does, and Bob, if Bob wants to compromise his own tunes, that's his business.
Well, so they eventually pulled out.
Here they are. Well, they eventually pulled out, but it took a long and painful series of adjustments to do that, and you know, in some instances, they thought that maybe this compromise they made would just be that they would make this compromise and they would go on, but the Chinese kept asking more and more, and in addition, there were some cultural missteps on Google's part that made things worse.
Well, they thought they would change China, but China actually was not ready to be changed. Now China has interfered with Gmail as related to events in the Middle East, and also they've been blocking the apps that help people locate friends and relatives in Japan.
Right. Well, once Google moved that search engine out, and it was a direct challenge to the Chinese government. And I have to say, there is something to admire when Google finally did take that decision. And say, you know what? Enough. Their competitors are still operating by, you know, and censoring. So Google finally came around and said, we can't do this anymore.
Well, in recent years, it's looked like Google's been a bit more vulnerable. They bought YouTube. That hasn't been a great success. They just lost in the courts on their book search case. They seem to be rather late in dealing with Facebook. Are they going to go the way of Xerox?
Well, I think that, you know, Google is still going to be a successful company for a very long time. And you mentioned YouTube. The other things you said, you know, absolutely dead on correct. But YouTube, I actually think is doing better than a lot of people think and will be more prominent in the future.
But some people felt they paid much too much for it.
They did pay too much for it, but as these things go on, it turns out to be a bargain. Everyone thought that Rupert Murdoch got a big bargain from MySpace, and now, you know, it's worth maybe as much as your newspaper, right? And you know what a newspaper is worth. So, but, you know, YouTube, Google admitted they paid almost $1 billion too much, and it is quite a bargain now.
And what about Facebook? They're a little late in addressing that.
Right. Well, Google's, you know, ironically, Google had a product that was very much like Facebook before Facebook, but they didn't take care of it well. And they've had some blunders in trying to come up with products in that social world, and they're going at it again.
Larry Page is coming back as the new CEO.
That's right.
Is this like Steve Jobs coming back to Apple?
Well, he never left. But now that he's in control, he's re-energized and, you know, because he's doing reorganization. And I think we'll see bigger things from Google.
Stephen Levy and David Kirkpatrick will be in conversation on Wednesday, May 25th at the 92nd Street Y in Tribeca. For more information, visit our show page. His book, In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show again,
Thank
Steve.
You. I enjoyed it.